Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello there. Welcome to Culture Lab. I'm Christy Taylor. This is the show where we talk all about how science shows up in our cultural creations, from books and movies to art and dance, or even how our society treats an essential health-related process that affects half the world's population at some point in their life. I'm talking about menstrual periods, which are both vital for creating new humans and, for some, a hassle they'd rather not deal with, ever. For others, menstruation is debilitatingly painful, a reason you might miss work or school several days a month. And in every case, understanding your period is also critical to understanding your health, whether you ever intend to become pregnant or not. But it's hard to talk about periods. And when we do, not everyone around us is receptive to hearing about it. At a time when American politicians are lobbying to restrict the rights of people to make decisions about their own fertility, from abortion restrictions to bans on in vitro fertilization, menstruation is also a highly politicized topic. Jen Gunter is a gynecologist who has dedicated her life to breaking down the stigma around crucial bodily processes. And her new book, Blood, is all about the menstrual period, from its amazingly unique status in mammalian biology to everything you ever wanted to know about how it works. And importantly, when your period might be an indicator of other health issues. Welcome, Jen. I want to start with periods 101. If we are taking a magic school bus trip through the ovaries and uterus, what are we seeing during the course of a menstrual cycle inside the body?
Oh, well, if you're inside the uterus, if you're in the clubhouse, so to speak, then what you'd see is a layer of cells getting thicker and thicker and thicker and more lush. You'd have almost envisioned a bit like shag carpet under the influence of estrogen in the first part of the menstrual cycle. And then after ovulation, you'd see sort of a change, more of a beefing up, if you will, of that tissue. So it sort of starts to look a bit more solid. And it would go from sort of looking more wave-like to just kind of even just like thicker and plumper. And that's under the influence of progesterone. And we call that interaction a process called decidualization. And that's really getting the lining prepared for implantation. And then there's all kinds of other stuff going on behind the scene. There are probably not something you could see, but we can definitely measure. There are, waves of contractions that move upwards in this more surface layer of the muscle of the uterus. And the belief is that those contractions are there to kind of move sperm upwards. And what's really fascinating about them is, they reverse in direction during menstruation, right? To sort of get the fluid out. And then with menstruation, what happens is there's a withdrawal of the hormone progesterone. The corpus luteum that makes progesterone runs out of gas, basically. And the loss of progesterone destabilizes the lining of the uterus. And that results in release of all kinds of chemicals, hormones, prostaglandins, and causes spasm of blood vessels. And the net result is the topmost part of the uterine lining, almost all of it, there's one layer that's left, peels off. And when that happens, blood vessels open up and blood comes out. So you have blood pushing that uterine lining out, and that's menstruation. And then at some point, the shower of blood stops and the blood vessels seal over and a new layer of carpet starts getting put down.
Let's pause and take a closer look at those contractions for a second, Jen. How strong are they? How much force are we talking about when we look at the uterus contracting?
Well, during menstruation, it's really significant. You know, it can generate easily 120 millimeters of mercury. For people who have painful periods, it can be much higher than that. And for someone who doesn't, you know, has sort of typical periods, that's kind of the force the uterus generates during labor when you're pushing a baby out. So it's not, you know, it's not an insignificant amount. You know, it's a heavy duty sort of force because it's got to push the stuff out. I mean, it's got to come out.
So we shouldn't be surprised that there's pain involved in this process then.
Exactly. And it's so fascinating because there's such a variety of pain experiences during menstruation. I mean, there are people who literally are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. What are you talking about? There's like, I feel zero pain. And obviously there's people who are in agony and everything in between. So, you know, we don't understand, do some people have maybe more sensitive uteruses in the sense they're more sensitive to the chemicals, so they get stronger contractions? Do some people have uncoordinated contractions, right? So the contractions are not working all together. Do some people produce more prostaglandins? Do some people have more receptors? You know, there's all different reasons for these potential differences to happen. And then also on top of that, you know, pain is also a personal experience, right? It's the only sense where we sort of incorporate that into the definition. So pain is super complex. And then, of course, it also depends if you have any other pain conditions, because that can change your nervous system to make you more vulnerable to pain. So there's a lot going on.
You also write about how unique menstruation is to humans. We are not the only animals that do it, but we are one of the only animals that do it.
Yeah, it's a very unique phenomenon in the animal kingdom. So there's us and some primates, and then there's some bats and the spiny mouse and the elephant shrew. So it's like this really like, it makes you think like of one five. Of those,
yeah,
some old children's song or some, you know, Aesop's fable, you know, that involved this like motley crew. And it is such a motley crew because, so if you consider us together with primates, it means menstruation developed evolutionarily four different times because we and the bats didn't branch off together, you know, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, does that indicate that we have a kinship with bats?
I know, right?
Like, I was previously like, unaware of.
Yeah, so no, we don't. I mean, we have the menstrual kinship. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's really fascinating that it's a value to some species and not value to other. And it is a reflection of how unique reproduction is, right? I mean, you see so many different lengths and gestations. You see, you know, some animals have litters. Some animals can have a pregnancy every single season. Some are seasonal breeders. It's really a fascinating thing when you start thinking about it.
Yeah. And on the other hand, many, many other animals do this thing called estrus for these cycles of being fertile. It's pretty different from menstruation. Why don't we do that? How is it different?
Yeah, I mean, so there's estrus, which the noticeable difference is obviously there's no menstruation. So there's no blood that comes out. And everybody else says, well, what about dogs? And dogs don't have menstruation. Their bleeding actually comes from their vagina. So it's not from their uterus. So it's a totally different thing. So they have estrus as well. So one of the big sort of physiologic differences is with a decidualization. So every pregnancy from a mammal has to have that decidualization. I talked about the exposure to progesterone to prepare the lining. But it's sort of when that preparation happens is the difference. So when you menstruate, the preparation for decidualization is already there when the embryo presents itself. So there's ovulation, there's release of progesterone, the lining is ready, and then the embryo comes along and potentially implants. With estrus, the trigger for decidualization is from the embryo. So it's what's called induced. So it's a totally different phenomenon. And with humans specifically, we have the thickest decidua. And so we believe that the reason humans need spontaneous decidualization is one, we have these incredibly invasive placentas. So they are like, they want oxygen. Because if you want to grow big brains, you need lots of oxygen, right? So the embryo is burying very deeply into the uterus. And so you think about a thick decidua as like a catcher's mitt. It can handle that, right? So if there wasn't a decidua ready and waiting, that invasive embryo would be like through the uterus. So you need that. But also, you know, humans have a very incredible energy investment in pregnancy. So pregnancy and breastfeeding are the most metabolically taxing things a human can do. There is nothing else at that metabolic limit. It's as metabolically demanding as doing something like the Tour de France or running a marathon every day, right? And then if you think about it evolutionarily, you know, blood loss during childbirth, injury during childbirth, being vulnerable to prey afterwards, then, you know, needing to have the evolutionary demand of breastfeeding and needing those extra calories, right? That's a lot of extra calories somebody's got to get for you. So you're adding all those things in, and then human infants are so vulnerable. They can't get up and walk like an elephant baby. They can't get up and walk like a giraffe. They can't climb on the back like a primate. They have actual incredibly vulnerable needs. And so that goes on for a long time. And they can't really look after themselves until they're sort of like 7 or 8, like sort of gathering food and things. So the decidua is involved basically in selecting the best quality embryos. Hmm. And so many people have heard that, oh, 70% of early pregnancies end in miscarriage. And many people miscarry before they even know they're pregnant. And that's because of the decidua.
So it's filtering embryos that might not have like, is it a genetic or a...
Yeah, it's quality control. So humans actually have a very high rate of chromosomal abnormalities in embryos. You know, everybody who talks about Mother Nature as being this sort of like kind, benevolent thing, I'm like, evolution's brutal, man. Like, it's really brutal.
It is, yeah.
You know? And that's why, you know, in the States, you know, you've heard about IVF has been in the news recently. And this whole idea, that's why you have to create so many embryos, even with IVF, to get one, because so many of them end up being kind of lower quality, right? And because that's the nature of human reproduction.
And when you're talking about lower quality, we're not talking in eugenics terms. You're actually talking truly about embryos that would not survive.
Right, right. Yeah, that you would not want to put a biological investment into a pregnancy that the fetus has no chance of surviving, right? So this is, you know, this is evolution. It's not, this isn't like picking eye color or, you know, something like that.
So it sounds like there are a lot of reasons to appreciate sort of the reproductive benefits of the way humans do, you know, ovulation and decidualization and preparation for pregnancy. There are also a lot of people who don't intend to use their uteruses for reproduction at all, or they're done, you know, with that and still have to deal with the menstrual cycle. I mean, what would you tell people who still just kind of find it a hassle or worse, you know, a painful process that they have to go through every month?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a hassle. I mean, you know, lots of people have asked me, you know, why am I not framing it as a gift? I'm like, well, if you frame it as a gift, that means nobody needs to bother studying it, right? Like, you should just be happy for your gift and shut up. So yes, all of life is a gift. If you want to think on the broader scale, of course, it's a gift and it's a privilege to be here. You know, and again, if you want to think about your own body that way as a gift, that's totally fine. But from a sort of scientist, medicine, sort of person who's seeing where the trajectory of science, especially with women's health, I think positioning menstruation as a gift is a really bad thing, because then it means it's not really something of value to study. And also, it's not a gift to everybody, just as you mentioned, right? Lots of people have painful periods. Lots of people have, you know, menstrual migraines. There's people who have PMS. There's people who bleed heavily. So I think that you can hold space for everybody thinking about their own body as they want to. But I think it's also important to think about this is just how we evolved to reproduce. And we live in a society that seems to punish the people that have the more kludgy biology.
Mm-hmm. Is kludgy a technical term?
No, I just love that term. I love that, yeah. Kludgy. You know, but again, everybody thinks of Mother Nature as, you know, or evolution as being perfect. And it's like, oh, evolution's motto is just good enough. It doesn't matter if that coat's 3 sizes too big. Let's put it on and slap your ass and push you out the door. You're good. You're good to go.
Did your children have children? Great.
Like... Yeah. Yeah. Basically, it's a low bar. Can your grandchildren feed themselves and, mm-hmm. you know, get to the next stage of reproduction? Yes.
You know. You know, you mentioned like some of the many unwanted additional sensations and experiences people have during menstruation, like migraines. Like, you've talked about menstrual diarrhea quite a lot. And I wonder, like, if we go back to just that process that's happening in the body every month, like, how is it touching so many systems at the same time?
So if you think about menstruation or the menstrual cycle as you're retrofitting a computer every month, or you're fitting a computer every month to take on a new program, right? Every month you're uploading a new operating system. You're like, oh, okay, we don't need it. Take it off, put it back on again. Take it off, put it back on again. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is really all driven by hormones, which are just communication tools in the body. Hormones are messengers. And many of the changes are happening locally in the uterus because that's obviously the star of the show. If the uterus isn't ready, there's no pregnancy. But you need hormones to get breast tissue going in the right direction. Hormones help trigger signals that help you produce more red blood cells that cause an increase in blood volume. Hormones are starting to also rewire your brain. So there's all these changes. You know, we have this incredible neuroplasticity, and there's all different kinds of changes that are happening in many places. Now, not all of it is a direct result of direct hormones. Sometimes it's due to the increased blood volume and increased blood flow that happens. Mm-hmm. You know, as a result of that. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, an incredible system when you think about it, that every month these changes have to happen. And for some people, there's a big price to be paid for that.
Mm-hmm. I want to get a bit into the myth busting that you do in this book too, because I think it's really important. And one of those things you talk about is you don't have to have your period in order to be healthy.
So we always need to make a difference between is something happening because of medication or something happening not because of medication, because medications have effects, right? So if you are on hormonal birth control and you're not getting a period anymore, that is totally normal consequence of that medication. And for many people, it's a beneficial consequence of that medication. And so what happens is, depending on the method of contraception, so if you're on oral birth control pill, or you have the implant, then what happens is you're not ovulating. So you're not getting, you know, the cyclic changes that produce the lining of the uterus. But in addition, all of these methods have more of the hormone class called progestins. So I remember I said it was estrogen that stimulates the lining and kind of progesterone that kind of solidifies the lining. Well, progestins are synthetic versions of progesterone, and they're even more effective on the lining of the uterus. That's one of the advantages of designing hormones in a lab. You can make them do more of the thing you want them to do. So they're even better at that. And so the progestins just completely oppose the effect of estrogen. And so basically, nobody's laying any carpet. There's just nothing there to develop. And so many, many people will not have any periods on hormonal contraception with progestins. Now, if you stop the pill, you know, every 21 days and have a 7-day off, you will probably get some withdrawal bleeding because, again, withdrawal of progesterone or progestins can trigger mm-hmm. bleeding.
But you're not actually ovulating on the pill.
You're not ovulating. Yeah. Versus if you have a hormonal IUD, you're still ovulating, but you just have so much progestin that the lining of the uterus never goes anywhere.
And on the other side of that, when is your period a legitimate medical issue? You know, when should someone seek care? Are there things people might worry about that they don't need to worry about?
Medically concerning would be if you skip a period for 3 cycles. So if you go 3 months without a period, you should be investigated. If you're at risk for pregnancy, you should also obviously have a pregnancy test as well. But there are many different things that can cause you to skip periods. If you're bleeding between periods, then you should mm-hmm. be investigated as well. There's many causes for that. And depending, again, on your age group or risk factors, one of them is actually chlamydia. And so, you know, you want to get screened and treated for that, because untreated chlamydia increases your risk of having, you know, serious pelvic infections. Mm-hmm. Then if you're bleeding super heavy, so if you are soaking your clothes, if you have clots that are bigger than a quarter, and I guess because there's a UK audience, maybe bigger than a 50-cent piece.
Okay.
If you're needing to change pads or tampons kind of every 1 to 2 hours. So that's a sign of heavy bleeding. If you're bleeding for more than 7 days. And finally, if you're just have a concern that you're not sure about, then, you know, we always want people to ask. Now, the things that you don't need to worry about are, you know, if your period is light, that's okay. Some people have lighter periods and some people have super soakers. But if you're, you know, your bleeding is 1 to 2 days and it's fairly light, that's okay. It's not a problem. Mm-hmm. And then for the things that don't really matter, the color of blood, it's got nothing to do with hormone status. They've actually checked hormones and menstrual blood. It's the same as hormones in your bloodstream. And that's because, shocker, it's blood from your bloodstream. It's just blood from the arteries and veins. Mm-hmm. So anyone who tells you that the color of your blood has any sort of reflection on hormones is like, doesn't understand basic biology. It can be tinged sort of light pink if there's just like a drop, maybe mixed in some cervical mucus, that type of thing. Oh, and bleeding after penetrative intercourse. We'd want someone to come in about that.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I want to talk then also about how we talk about periods. And I will say, like, it's been quite a long time since I read, like, What's Happening to My Body, book for girls, and learned about my own menstrual cycle. And it's not necessarily something that stays in the conversation after you're sort of at the age where your parents are maybe explaining it to you, or maybe they're not. How do you see sort of the dialogue around menstruation unfolding now, but also sort of over time?
Yeah. So I think how we're talking about it now really is a reflection of certainly how it's been treated in Western society. So, you know, there's still this culture of, you know, not talking about it, and whether it's shame or whether it's just not something that's done, you know, like in polite company. That's a legacy of periods being, you know, toxic, polluting, dirty, you know, this sort of line that historically women have been sort of forced to walk, right? You know, to be a woman historically has been to sort of walk the edge of a knife. You're either a slut or, you know, you're a prude. My God, you know, menstruation is a sign that someone could have sex with you, but we also want you to be a breeder. Like, you know, it's sort of this weird sort of dichotomy. And then of course, when it stops, it's not that you've lost your toxic, polluting periods and you're now like a good member of society. Now you're useless. So it's this whole, like, it's just so messed up. And I think we carry a lot of that baggage still today. I mean, how many people still do what I call the tampon Olympics, where you take a tampon and stuff it up your sleeve if you have to walk to the bathroom, and then you're like, run to the bathroom, like, you know, walk briskly with your tampon or your pad or whatever you're concealing. And it's like, people walk around blowing their nose. Like, infectious snot is coming out of their face and they're okay with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, people are on airplanes coughing and sneezing without wearing a mask, and somehow walking to the bathroom with a tampon is gross. Okay, record scratch, freeze frame. Let's just talk about what's actually disgusting, because nothing about menstruation is contagious.
Yeah.
But people act still like it is. And I'll tell you, you know, in the US, there was very little interest from, you know, big press in this book. You know, I was asked to pitch stuff to some big publications, and they were like, I don't think really anyone's interested in that. I'm really, like, half the people menstruate. And, you know, the morning shows don't want to talk about this kind of thing because it's like, sensitive ears might be listening. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen to them? Like, do you think they're going to turn into witches, like, and bring down the patriarchy? Like, that would be cool, but that's not going to happen.
Which is so interesting, because I remember, like, when the COVID mRNA vaccines were first being taken up in large numbers, and there was so much hand-wringing about fertility and the menstrual cycle. And it's like, people were only interested in talking about menstruation in the context of what felt like a very anti-science and conspiratorial line of thinking, but also, like, it, you know, it served a political purpose too, but it didn't actually help people who menstruate at the end of the day.
Oh, absolutely. So first of all, fear sells. And there's no better fear that sells than scaring women about their bodies, mm-hmm. right? And I always get back to, like, phosphodiesterase inhibitors, which are like Viagra and that class of drugs, they have blindness as a risk. And nobody's ever heard of that. Like, that's never once been a major news story. And, you know, the risk of blindness with phosphodiesterase inhibitors is, you know, maybe about the same as the risk of a serious complication with osteoporosis medications, the bisphosphonates, and a complication called osteonecrosis. That was on the front page of the news, you know. So scaring women about their normal physiology, or not even normal, even medical conditions, anything to treat them. And it's such this awful dichotomy, because it's like, we're going to scare you about what happens if you don't take it, but then we're going to scare you about what happens if you take it. And that gets back again to my on the edge of a knife. Mm-hmm. You know, keeping people off balance is a core weapon of the patriarchy. And we're still seeing, you know, the press carry water for that every single day. And it's really shocking to me. I guess it shouldn't be, but half the freaking population menstruates. Like, how many news stories are that applicable? Like, a lot of times you're like, oh, that's like really niche. I'm never going to go visit that part of the country. That's really niche. I'm never going to, I don't eat that kind of food or whatever. You know, I don't like barbecue, but yet there's a major news story about barbecue, you know, whatever. And it's like, wow, but menstruation, not important. Okay, got that.
As you keep saying, half the population menstruates. This half of the population also stops menstruating at a point in their lifetimes. So what do people not understand about menopause that they should?
So, you know, menopause is a normal physiologic event like puberty. All mammals, their ovaries have, you know, are able to produce follicles for a very specific length of time. And then basically they run out of follicles that can ovulate. Now, most mammals then die. It's evolution. You're here for the next generation. Okay, you can't do that anymore. Bye. But humans and killer whales keep on living. And so we have a very long post-reproductive life. And the theory behind that is that, you know, it's probably not a shocker to half the population listening, but you're actually of value to society if you've been through a lot of things, but now you're no longer encumbered with child rearing, right? So imagine having a pair of hands to help you if, you know, you're 10,000 years ago. And remember I said breastfeeding is, you know, about 500 extra calories a day. How are you going to get those 500 extra calories? Wait a minute. If there's somebody invested in helping you, then you might get those 500 extra calories. Humans have very difficult childbirths compared to other animals. And so having another pair of hands around who has done it before is useful. And so that's called the grandmother or wise woman hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the physiologic reason we think for it happening. Basically, menopause is evolution, the long game, right? You're able to kind of help produce more grand offspring. And it's a complex physiologic change, just like puberty. And for some people, there can be terribly bothersome symptoms, like with puberty, right? Some people got terrible acne. Some people, puberty triggered depression. That's the same thing that can happen on the other end of sort of the menstrual bookends. The risk of osteoporosis starts to go up. We think that it's also related in part to the risk of dementia, but we for women, but we don't actually really fully understand the pathophysiology of that. And so, you know, it's really important that people realize that, you know, menopause is a time to check in about your cardiovascular health, your bone health, all these things. But people also shouldn't freak out. There's a lot of alarmist accounts on social media talking about menopause as if you're going to die unless you go on hormones. Hormone therapy is a great tool. If you have hot flashes, night sweats, if you are somebody at risk for osteoporosis, it's a great tool for that. It's also a moderate tool for other things like depression in the menopause transition, joint pain, maybe reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes for people at high risk. So it also is moderately successful at doing some other things. So for many people, it's a good therapy. But if you're not having any symptoms, then you don't need it. And I always like to remind people that, you know, in 1900, before hormones were commercially available at all, the life expectancy for women was longer than the life expectancy for men. So painting menopause as sort of, you know, an expiration date doesn't really fit with the biology, the idea that we have this post-reproductive life.
You've talked about how underfunded and under-researched the uterus and accompanying organs are. And also, we have made scientific advances to make being a person who menstruates, being a person who goes through menopause a lot easier. You know, you've mentioned hormone treatment. What have we managed to figure out in studying these processes? And what does that speak to in terms of the possibility if, you know, we actually invested even more enthusiastically and equitably in this research?
Yeah. So, you know, we understand a lot, but also, you know, in science, you don't know what you don't know, right? Like in the 1980s, we all thought vaginal bacteria was just Lactobacillus acidophilus because that's the only one we could really grow. And then along came DNA technology, where we could use, you know, fragments of DNA and amplify it and identify new species. Now, everything we know about the vaginal microbiome is completely different from what we found in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Like, that may as well not even exist. It's completely wrong. But then what if there's another tool that's developed? So you always have to be like, We don't know what we don't know. But we know a lot about a lot of things with reproduction and the reproductive system. But we don't understand a lot about the uniqueness. So for example, I'll give fibroids as an example. Fibroids are benign tumors that affect the uterus. They're very common. You know, by your late 40s, 70% of white women will have them. And actually, it's even higher for Black women. It's over 80%. They're benign. They don't cause cancer. However, for some people, they can cause terrible symptoms. And other people, they don't cause any symptoms at all. And they're only picked up because they're like, wait a minute, I feel this massive thing in your belly and we need to investigate it. So how can something that for some people might be the size of a pea cause terrible bleeding? And for some people, it doesn't cause terrible bleeding until it's the size of a baseball. And for someone else, it never causes terrible bleeding, even though it's the size of a soccer ball or a football, if you're, you know, in the UK, right? Like, why? And so I think it's those things that we don't understand. And I think they're really critical because women have often been dismissed as being hysterical, for lack of a better word. And if you look back and you say, well, half the people with big fibroids, and I'm just picking that number out of the air, it might not be correct. If half the people with fibroids have no symptoms, then when you see the other half, if you don't have the intellectual curiosity, the other half who are complaining of symptoms, you might think that they're just complainers, as opposed to, wait a minute, half the people have symptoms and half the people don't. Right? So that's why it's super important for us to understand more about this physiology so we can understand the differences. The other thing that we really don't understand is endometriosis, which is a condition where cells very similar to the lining of the uterus grow outside in the pelvic cavity. And we don't really understand the basic biology of it. We don't understand if it's a normal phenomenon that the cells normally get there and that for some people, those cells go awry. We don't know if there's genetic reasons. We don't know why it is. And again, there are people who are filled with endometriosis who have like no symptoms. I remember operating on somebody for, removing her uterus because she had like a precancer. And she had the worst endometriosis I've ever seen in my life. We had to bring in a cancer surgeon and it was like an hours and hours and hours long procedure to get this all out. And afterwards, I'm like, so did you ever have painful periods? And she's like, no. She said, I've never taken an ibuprofen in my life. And she had no infertility issues, boom, 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 three pregnancies. And you're just like, how is that? And yet you can see someone with very minimal endometriosis who is filled with pain. And again, all these variations in between. Do you have genetic variations in your immune system? Are there variations in those cells? Because the thing is, if we don't understand the basic biology, then you can't develop drugs, right? Because you have to know on what part of the body, the immune system, whatever, for those medications to act. And that's one of the legacies of governments having less interest in studying the basic biology. And for years, one of the only investments in sort of the basic, biology of the reproductive tract for women has literally been in conception and pregnancy. Again, it's like, oh, right. So we want to know how you can breed better. And look, as someone who's had serious pregnancy complications, that's super important. And we don't want to play like favorites, but it does kind of say something when the bulk of the research has been about how to have a better conception, a better pregnancy outcomes. And there's like a dearth of research for the lives that are lived outside of those moments of time.
Going back to IVF, which, in the US, we saw the state of Alabama pass a law saying fetuses are persons. And that has had consequences for people who are trying to generate embryos in order to have children at all. And the remarkable thing to me with this is that the lawmakers who supported that law seemed really surprised that it had this consequence for people who are trying to have children. Is that a misinformation problem? Why do you think this is happening?
The short answer is they're idiots. I mean, that's really the short answer. The long answer is they have no intellectual curiosity and it's all about power. Many years ago, when I lived in a different state, we had an abortion restriction where we were not allowed. It had changed while I was there from having a very liberal abortion law to not being allowed to do abortions at the hospital I worked at, unless it was the life of the mother. And one of those situations came up. And the way that we worked around this was the lawyers had me call the politician who wrote the law at home. And I started explaining the situation to him, and I was so prepared. I could have been like getting up at the biggest medical conference in the whole world, and I would have been able to answer every question because I was going to bat for that woman. Mm-hmm. And I had maybe said five words, and he said, "Oh, doctor, whatever you think, just do that." And that really told me they don't care. They don't care. It is a political tool. And they have no intellectual curiosity to look at what the consequences are, because laws that hurt women get politicians elected. They do. Not everywhere, but they certainly do. Now it's a lot of it's to do with in the United States, there's massive voter disenfranchisement. So this isn't just people making decisions that maybe I wouldn't make. It's many people, you know, I was trying to explain to some friends in Canada recently that, you know, people don't have protected time off work to go vote in the US, right? There's many places they don't have mail-in voting, you know, so you see the lines in some states of people waiting for hours to vote or ID. So it's very complex as to how these people get in, right? But the fact of the matter is the press carries water for them. Their propaganda gets repeated. And when they have such a political control, a lock, you know, there are very few people, for example, maybe in the, you know, the House that can challenge them on the floor. It gets spun in a way that there's no consequences for the people making these awful laws. And yeah, they were backpedaling a bit with the IVF, but it's blown over now. Mm-hmm. It's gone, right? They don't care. It is just about being in power. And if hurting reproduction wasn't the thing, then they would look into hurting something else. And obviously we see that with rights for transgender people, and we see that with rights for marriage equality. And so, you know, it's all tied together. And so, yeah, it's I think they have zero curiosity and they just don't care, which is really depressing. Well,
it is. And I want to immediately ask a question about making the world a better place, which I assume starts with everyone reading and understanding the material in your book. But, you know, how do you envision a society that does hold the necessary space for menstruating people, people going through menopause, our rights, our comfort, our, you know, medical safety? Like, what do you see that world as looking like?
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine something you've never experienced, right?
Little sob. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, everything, every workplace we're in, every single thing that we're in is like patriarchal in, you know, it was designed by men, right? So I would say that I'm open to, or I would like to see a society where people aren't punished for having the very biology that creates the society, right? We need to have a next generation, even from a personal sort of thinking only of yourself. If we stop reproducing when you're old, there isn't going to be a doctor or nurse to look after you, right? So we all need the next generation. But somehow that's become the sole responsibility of half the population. And just because you have the biology to produce the next generation doesn't mean that you should be the person doing all the child rearing. It doesn't mean that, you know, if you want to work outside the home, that you should be punished for that. You should be paid less because you have that biology, right? So I think that for me, a very equal society would be, you know, a platform where having the reproductive biology to produce the next generation isn't weaponized against you for minimal. And then to actually be the fact that it's studied equally, so we can make sure that we are devoting as much care to it as we need. And, you know, from a workplace standpoint, like, I'm not a workplace expert. And when they said they were, some places were going from 5 to 4 days a week, right? I said, that's, no one's ever going to be more productive. And then, you know what? They showed the data and they were. And so, you know, I suspect that if we gave people the leave they need to take care of their bodies, and also though made sure that they were able to take care of their bodies. So for example, in the US, maybe you don't have health insurance. So that's why you're missing 2 days a month of work because you couldn't get access to medical care to treat your periods, right? So we got to fix that issue. But, you know, if we had a held space for people, as long as that you're being productive, you can sort of do that in a variety of different ways. What would society look like? I think it'd probably look pretty good, actually. I think it'd be like probably a matriarchal utopia.
I should definitely pressure our office to at least stock the bathroom with period supplies, because currently it does not.
That is the very minimum. So when I say, like, if every single bathroom you walked into had menstrual supplies, that's it. Just that's it. There was no other change made. that would actually just get people thinking about it. And for all bathrooms, all genders, even if there's not one person in a man's bathroom who's ever going to use it, right? So maybe that's a possibility. Just seeing it there is something that I think changes things. It makes it less gross. It makes it less scary. It makes it less all those things. It makes it more equal. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, look, my son is 20. He is a very outspoken young gay man, and he has pads and tampons in his bathroom in his little dorm in school. You know, I mean, I'm like, okay, that's fine. You're using the money I send you to do that. I don't have a problem with that.
But he's a good friend. He's clearly a good friend.
Right? Like that's like, and I didn't tell him to do that. Like he thought of that all on his own. And I was like, wow, that's really a good thing. I'm really proud of you.
Jen, thank you so much for the time today. This was a really wonderful conversation, and I didn't get to have the questions I would have wanted to ask you. So,
oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was a great conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Culture Lab from New Scientist Podcasts. That was Jen Gunter, a gynecologist and author. Her newest book is Blood: The Science, Medicine, and Mythology of Menstruation. If you liked this interview, make sure you subscribe to our feed for more like it. Plus, there's our weekly news podcast and the delightfully diverting Escape Pod. Those all drop right here every Friday and Tuesday. Find more journalism from New Scientist on our website at newscientist.com. I'm Christy Taylor. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.